In Brazil, the estimate I think now is there are about 100,000 of these basic ecclesial communities, numbering anywhere from maybe 20 to 60 people, maybe 100, maybe 120, but usually tending to be more small. There's a lot of good information about that, and I just found there was a tape in the tape library that already gave my presentation, I guess. I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, by Muggy? Yeah, who has been there and has had better contact with it than I have. So if you want more information on that, that's a good place to go to. There's a lot of excitement about what's happening in these communities, and that's what I was interested in, learning about what was happening there and what might happen in my own parish, learning from their situation. They do theology in a form that is generally lumped together as theology of liberation. Latin America is probably the place to look to see these most commonly, but they're all over the world. Africa, Asia, Pakistan, even some in the first world, what we would call. Liberation theology is a way of understanding God as active in history with a particular concern for the oppressed. And there are phrases like the preferential option for the poor, that God is not fair, he is biased. She is biased. What am I doing? God is concerned for the poor above all. And the liberation theologians have no problem going through the scripture and showing that to us. They say, how come you never paid attention to the theme of oppression? This scholar goes through the Old Testament and picks out 20 different Hebrew roots that all mean oppression. I remember when we were in Alaska, we used to kid about how the Eskimos had so many different words for snow. They knew about snow, and so they had a lot of different words to describe it. There are not that many Hebrew roots to begin with, and to have over 20 of them dealing with oppression. Somehow nobody ever noticed that before. Nobody ever followed through the themes of oppression very well. These folks are doing that, and they're saying God is at work setting things right in the world. I really can't do a lot on theology of liberation right now, but again, there are ways of getting into that. What we want to focus on tonight is the notion that the poor evangelize the rich. We are so used to being in the position of being the evangelizers. Our notion is we send missionaries out, we sent them into the whole world. I grew up, you know, we were giving money to send somebody to some place, and we all have a feeling that sort of has stopped somewhat, that mission work is done a little differently now. We're very concerned to get indigenous congregations, and that's really neat. The next step is that now they're sending missionaries to us. They have taken the gospel into themselves, and they said, we understand a little differently than you do, and we've got a word for you. And so they send back words. The trio that came from the Japanese Evangelical Lutheran Church that Ron talked about, Mrs. Nakanishi and the two pastors, were official delegates sent by the Japanese Evangelical Lutheran Church with a mission to the United States. They were sending missionaries to us. Tonight we want to look at how the third world, particularly Latin America, has a word to speak to us. And in the couple thousand pages that I was reading, they didn't say much to us, really. And so I had to kind of pull it together from here and there. They were primarily trying to address their own problem and not trying to lay a guilt trip on us or to do something else. So I just need to kind of put that in perspective. One of the things that I have noticed is that they use the word evangelize in a very different way. Theology of liberation is not really interested in saving people out of the world, but in liberating oppressed people from all the things that oppress them. So evangelize means not just to tell good news about heaven, but to set free. So when the poor evangelize the rich, they are setting us free. That's one thing, just to note the words. one of the things that I have felt as I have watched poor people gain power in the world is the tremendous lack of anger and revenge. I remember when Rhodesia became Zimbabwe, we were all watching for a slaughter of the whites. And there was some violence, but basically it was incredible the kind of forgiveness that was there. Ron mentioned that Mrs. Nakanishi was here asking for forgiveness and not saying, "You dropped this terrible bomb on us." You know, that there is not the anger. It's incredible, a gift of the poor. One writer, though, has a piece that really strikes me with irony. The irony is that he says, the poor don't need us for their salvation, but we need them for our salvation. And it's worth just his paragraph here. What is at stake here might be expressed incisively as follows. Whereas the oppressed poor person, strictly and scandalously speaking, would not need to emerge from poverty in order to be finally saved by the justice of God's love, the rich person can be saved only by ceasing to oppress the poor. Therefore, when the oppressed poor person, or when the oppressed poor accept the gospel as good news of liberation and actually strive to become liberated from the oppression that is being suffered, they are, ipso facto, battling against the sin of the oppressor and inviting the latter to conversion, and are making the greatest gesture of Christian love toward the latter. It is in this paradoxical way that the poor of the base communities proclaim good news of liberation to the rich who are oppressing them. James O'Halloran, in his book, The Living Cell, says, "It is in this way that the well-off are saved. The option for the poor is not an option against the rich. Rather, they are invited to liberate themselves by liberating others. Our liberation comes as we become liberators, as opposed to being oppressors. The poor are already, in a sense, free because they've heard the good news and it's theirs. They can possess it." Very briefly, I want to talk about three aspects of being set free, of being evangelized from our perspective. How does that occur for us? Thomas Hanks in God So Loved the Third World can see how they see things a little differently. Has some words to say about, first of all, we need an awareness of ourselves and of our situation. He says, "The first step is that I must become aware of my own situation in the light of God's attitude toward injustice. Jesus spoke of the poor, the slaves, the sick, and the oppressed. I must recognize that this also faithfully describes my own personal condition. If that is not the case, Jesus has nothing to give to me." As Jesus himself told the Pharisees, who considered themselves healthy and righteous, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance." All of us are simultaneously oppressed and oppressors. Satanic oppression occurs not only on the level of economic class struggle, but in all areas of human life. We saw oppression in the film at 7 o'clock. In families, in schools, at the local fast food restaurant, as also on the great landed estates and in the large multinational companies, the poor, oppressed working man tyrannizes his wife and children more often than we might care to believe. Thus, the first step in genuine Christian discipleship is humbly to recognize my own situation. I am an oppressed oppressor. If I let pride and self-interest close my eyes to my own personal needs and faults, I will never be able to experience the liberation that Jesus offers. I can deceive neither God nor my friends, only myself. If we claim to be without sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us.
Heard that someplace.
Self-deception is the worst kind of blindness. And then he adds, precisely because God is love, he cannot remain indifferent to the oppression of the poor. If that is our situation, needing to recognize what our condition is, Leonardo Boff, another Latin American theologian, in his version of St. Francis, subtitled A Model for Human Liberation, tries to describe what our situation is. And it's a squirmy kind of picture. When I read it, I went, that's us. Maybe you will, too. He speaks of emptiness, loneliness, fear, anxiety, aggressiveness without objectives, in a word, general dissatisfaction, as description of the dominant culture. And he fleshes that out a bit. Emptiness is born of a feeling of impotence, that there is little we can do to change our own life and that of society, and finally, that nothing is important. Loneliness is expressive of the loss of contact with nature and others in terms of friendship and gentleness. There is a lack of courage to commit ourselves. Fear is the fruit of the objective threats of life to employment, to collective survival of humanity in general. Anxiety has its origin in imagined fear, ignorance as to what one ought to do, in whom to trust, and what to expect. When anxiety grips an entire society, it means that the whole society feels threatened and senses its approaching end. Generalized aggressiveness reveals a rupture with the norms of the relationship, without which a society cannot be built or defended. What results is anonymity and the loss of the meaning of self, that is, the worth and sacredness of the human person. From all of this, there derives two consequences no less serious: emptiness and the loss of the language of everyday communication, the loss of meaningful personal relationships, and the loss of a vital relationship with nature. And to any empty, threatened, anxious, aggressive individual, this same nature appears mute, indifferent, and dead. A similar absence of enthusiasm aids the breakdown of ecosystems. This adds to, generally, the excesses of irrationality. He goes on just a bit more on that theme. I just want to put those words up so that we kind of keep them in mind. This is the situation of the oppressed. Of the oppressor, rather. Emptiness. Loneliness. Fear. Anxiety. Generalized aggressiveness. We can come back to those and you can see it. You can argue as to whether they're descriptive or not. One writer, Berryman, says that one of the reasons we have a hard time getting handles on our problem is that there's no clear crisis. Says when you're oppressed, you know, you've got all of this on top of you, you know what the problem is, you know where it's coming from pretty easily. And we're going, what do we do? How do I get a handle on it? What is the crisis that I can lay hold of that I can focus on that will lead me out of this ambiguity and into some kind of action? He says, the lack of a clear sense of crisis in society is probably the most important reason why the United States Church has not developed its own equivalent to liberation theology. To my mind, the crisis issue for the United States Church is the manufacture, possession, and preparation for use of nuclear arms. It is theological. The arms race is idolatry and a denial of the God of life. Berryman envisions a systematic effort to organize study action groups around the nuclear war issue. He sees that as maybe the closest thing that we would have to what is happening in Latin America. And that these would extend then beyond the nuclear war issue to an understanding of what it means to have an enemy, of the general problem of militarism, of the economic effects of militarism, and then on greater into our political and our international affairs, and how we deal with all of that, and all the ways that we're oppressed, sexism and racism. He sees it working out from that one focus as a beginning point. I'm not sure if we would all agree that that's the one place to start, but that's the place he identifies as a possible crisis that we could work from. If the first thing is and an awareness of Jesus as liberator, of a liberation that occurs through every aspect of life. And I'm not sure that we have understood Jesus in that way. We have understood him more as one who teaches, perhaps, the way we ought to live. We've had a variety of different ways of understanding him, or one who, by believing in him, we are saved in some kind of way, but as one who liberates us in every aspect of our life to be free and to be whole as God has created us to be. That kind of a focus on Jesus is what they're calling for. I'm not going to try to flesh that one out too much more. If that does not ring bells easily, then you can pick up on that later. Third stage, then, of being set free is conversion. These stages, by the way, are written by an evangelical. if you don't recognize the pattern, first you got to realize you're a sinner. then you got to meet Jesus, and then you've got to turn your life over. Very evangelical pattern. The only Protestant that I ran across in all of my readings, the rest were all Roman Catholic. But that's the pattern of Thomas Hanks, an evangelical biblical scholar. Conversion. A couple of things that are said about conversion. One is that one person says, the poor do not need our pity or our charity. They need our conversion. But even more, we need to be converted because of our situation, because we're here. We need to be converted out of that. We need to be converted to something. And again, Leonardo Boff, in his interpretation of St. Francis, begins to draw a picture of what that is that we need to be liberated or converted toward. He talks about movements that are hunting for that. He says, the strength of movements that search for a new meaning for living, linked to earthly roots, to simplicity, to respect, to gentleness with others, and the care of nature, will take on a worldwide significance. Very simple things. You can see where he's working from St. Francis with those themes. And he says that the poor are the ones who have precisely the characteristics that we're seeking. The struggle for life, work, exploitation made the popular masses the guardians of those very values that we so often miss. And then he lists them, and I'll just put them up too. This is what we're set. Oops, I had nice categories for this. This will be living in freedom. Is that we're called to, or the poor have these characteristics and we need them. Hospitality rings bells here at Holden. Cordiality. Ryan can break that one down to its roots for us. The heart. Solidarity. Sense of respect.
Just a second.
For the sacredness of God. And of natural things. I'll settle for nature here. Especially life. That these are the gifts or the treasures that the poor have held for us. A few weeks ago, someone, Ledbetter was presenting on Thomas Merton, and the question was raised, why be a monk? And one of the responses was, when the world became crazy, it was the monks who preserved humanity for us. I see the same kind of pattern here, that they're saying that when we became crazy, it was the poor who preserved humanity for us. One thing I'd want to add to this, from my own reading, and in a sense it's the book that got me going in this general direction. If the process is conversion, what is real conversion and how does that happen? Jim Wallace, in The Call to Conversion, does a study of what conversion is. And he says that conversion is not change of belief system, primarily. That's usually what we define it as. I believe in this, not that. I've changed from this to that. He says that conversion is the changeover of life, the turning around. In some way, that again, we got another tradition speaking there, that's Anabaptist. Lutherans would probably talk about sanctification. Am I close? The ongoing process of being changed. Is that accurate? That ring bells? So in some ways, we want to include in conversion the sanctification, the growing that goes on. Wallace says that conversion doesn't take place beyond the level of words, unless we're linked in community. Only in community can conversion take place. Communities that have these kinds of characteristics. Otherwise, the world conforms us back to itself again, very quickly, in spite of whatever we might say. Wallace's argument is for a new shape to Christian community. That congregations need to foster small communities that are focused on characteristics like on these characteristics, that's what I was looking for, that are focused on a concern for worship, that are focused on a way of theologically reflecting about our lives and our situation together, that identify with the poor, and that seek justice. That in order for us to change from this to this, we need the power of community to enable us to do it. That's how I got into this whole study, trying to find out what was going on in these communities down in Central America. That's a model of what the poor have to say to us, how they evangelize us, and what I'd like to do is to let Ron, if you would, sort of chair this as a discussion, because I have a tendency to run off at the mouth.
Okay. He's going to give it to me.
Punt.
Well, thanks. That's, yeah.
One more thing. I'd hoped that Dan might be here. Most of us have been in his Bible study, and one of the pictures that he drew for us was the picture of the globe with hunger and oppression and concerns and the pocket. And what this is about is toward that direction. How do you live in the pocket of wealth? What does that mean? And how do you do that without being crippled by guilt or being defensive so much. That's how I'd wanted to relate that with his work, but.
Any responses to what we heard?
It seems to me that most churches that I've been familiar with have this as a facade for living in freedom. They have the hospitality, so and so caring for so and so, they have mottos. Cordiality, cab stop and have a cup of coffee. Solidarity, where live terms, and we did this and that, and so forth. Sense of respect. Seems like it's got the facade, but it seems like deep down there's a shakiness about it all. And there's a shaking going on somewhere where things are not as solid as people want them to appear on the surface. So it seems to me churches are trying to live in freedom, Lutheran churches that I've been familiar with, but somehow it's not coming across that way, truly.
Those, in a sense, they could be marks of the community, too. Maybe I should put up those marks of the community, because those are ones I think that we heard on and that make these kind of shallow. I know some of you can't see this. Worship, and again, we've got that. Theological reflection. Identification with the poor. And seeking justice. Those last three, I don't think we're too good on. Theological reflection we talked about before in one of the earlier sessions, and that means not just Bible study or prayer. They talk about three stages of a group, a maturing of a group. The first is when we gather to study the scriptures and to join in prayer. The second, though, which is a much deeper experience, is when that is combined by relating it to the lives of the people that are there. And so it's not just a matter of studying what God has to say about life and death, but relating that to Carol, who has cancer, who's in our group. Third level is when you connect that with a reflection on the shape of your world. It's economics, it's politics. And that's when you're able to begin dealing with justice. In fact, they call the second level a community of mutual aid or community of charity. And liberation theology would call into question charity. They'd say what we're looking for is justice. And you don't get that from mutual. I think most the best Bible studies that I'm part of are on the second level, where we relate the scriptures to our immediate situation, to the people around. It's very rare that we actually try to point it, target it at our larger society. That's a place where we fall down. I fall down. I lead those studies.
I think it's one thing that liberation theology attempts to do is to connect the temporal world with the spiritual world. And I think that's something that we aren't very good at. That we keep our faith pretty separate from the rest of our lives or from our citizenship or occupation or that kind of thing.
That was blatantly apparent in the LCA Peace and Politics statement that was just passed this summer. In its original draft, I was one of the reviewers, the whole thing was based on a split between the peace of Christ and temporal peacemaking. One was a spiritual peace, one was a temporal peace. Liberation theology would say, no, you can't do that. In the second draft, one that was finally passed, they threw those categories out because we named them for what they were. You're trying to slip two kingdom theory on us here, and we all know that doesn't work right now. And so they took temporal and spiritual out, and they put instead that peacemaking in the world begins from the first article. It has to do with creation. It has to do with the created order. It hasn't got anything at all to do with redemption. It hasn't got anything at all to do with Jesus, is really what the Peace and Politics statement said. And every time people tried to draw in Jesus and his way of dealing with things, that got shoved aside, and it went back to this notion that dealing with politics, dealing with peacemaking in the world is only a matter of this world, creation alone, which is bad theology in a number of ways, but that's the way we did it. They would not, that's what you're, they talk about planes of history, spiritual and temporal. You can't separate them.
I guess I wonder, though, given where we are as the, you know, white middle-class church in America, how do we move beyond that, making those distinctions? I think it's easy. I'm hopeful for more theological reflection, but I also get worried when it's very academic, because I don't know how to make what we're talking about really relevant. So that it is, you know, something that has meaning for congregations.
Well, this is part of the problem, that if every time we get into Bible studies that have needs, we immediately run up against our idols, the money, security from something other than God, like bombs, and then we don't want them. We're just tied to those things. Those are real and strong idols to us, and we can't get past that. And secondly, community. We can't have community in the midst of this affluent, frantic world. We're so busy running here and hither and thither. How can we have community with somebody, with people we can only see once a week or maybe twice?
If you dare.
And the dynamics of materialism,
yeah,
precisely divide us from one another. I was listening to a tape by John Schramm on Community Christ the Servant, and he talked about at one point, after they'd really gotten to know each other for quite a while, one evening they got off talking about their incomes. I forget exactly what it was. He said, "You've never seen so much anxiety in that group." And these are people that have worked and trusted one another, and, you know, and they're going, "Well, look, we all know what John makes. You know, we're paying his salary as coming out of such and such, and maybe we ought to do some sharing about that." And he said it was really scary for people. It was difficult for them to do.
I think that's a really insightful. I think even if we were to sit around here and say, "Okay, let's all talk about our salaries and our income," we get nervous in our communities. Just think of how the best kept secret in the workplace is what?
Salary.
Unless you work for the government.
That's right.
Or the church.
It's not too much of a secret at an annual meeting.
Right. Yeah. But of the people that you're in contact with, sure, ours is sort of, but it's like mine isn't. It's always, students are always curious. Faculty members would be appalled if they knew how much money I made. Because they really are poorly paid. And I happen to know that compared to salaries. And it's very interesting how quiet they are. They never meant it. And how sheepish everyone is when you even bring up this the subject. The fear and anxiety level rises.
Well, I think even more so than that is if you started talking about how much you give.
Yeah.
The church. and who gives what, you know, the person you think that would give the most generally doesn't. I mean, very generalizations. And those that you don't think give that much do give a greater percentage of their income. Anyway, on your model, I thought I heard you say yesterday when you were talking, or the day before, about Marilyn Finn, when she was critiquing liberation theology. Thought you kind of quoted her questioning whether that model would work here.
Yeah.
Have you got some thoughts?
In some ways, this is not liberation theology. And I think some of the things that have happened, I think she did that in 1980, and some of the things that have happened, for instance, this piece by Hanks, where he goes into this intensive study on oppression, and he comes up with a conclusion, you don't have to use Marxist analysis to understand oppression. The whole Old Testament is an analysis of oppression. Marxist analysis, in a sense, is used to enable people to figure out why they're poor, because they're oppressed. That's how the Bible defines poor. When you look, why are people poor in the Bible? He'll argue consistently on all the roots, people are poor not because they're lazy, not because they sinned, not because of any of the other reasons we might come up with. They're poor because they're oppressed. Somebody has taken advantage of them. And so that was one major critique that she had of liberation theology, was that it was using Marxist social analysis. And that was in 1980, and they probably still are using that. But there are people there saying, you don't have to. And so there's variations in that. This also is a way of just simply listening to the poor. And that doesn't require Marxist analysis. The Vatican was able to do that. You know, they were able, Vatican II, and subsequently they were able to do that kind of saying that we need to identify with the poor. If we're not the church of the poor, we're not the church. It's nice to have Roman Catholic leadership like that. They can say that for the whole church, but we haven't quite figured out how to get that said by Lutherans. We have to have a convention.
The other thing said too, liberation theology, about becoming a poor church, that I think is kind of an interesting concept. I wish I knew more, I could expound on that more, but I guess maybe it would contrast the idea of charity with actually unity. I mean, of us being kind of handing things down rather than just kind of bringing ourselves down.
Cool. Yeah, and then this model, of course, says that we absolutely depend upon the poor for our salvation. You know, how are we going to be judged? Well, did you visit the person who was in prison? Did you feed the hungry? Did you clothe the naked? That's how you'll be judged. Our salvation depends upon our relationship with the poor. At least that's one way of reading it. And so it becomes a very great import. Not only salvation at the end of time. It's not as though we're going through this mystery of life and at the end God's going to suddenly spring this one on us. It's all of these things. All of these things. Because we're out of touch with the poor. Because we live in a society where there's oppression and domination going on, we have these diseases now. We're already suffering the punishment.
Back to Mary's question, how do we get to, you know, to that point? I think, you know, we mentioned charity. It's interesting, Chuck Lutz was up here from ALC headquarters in June. He did some sessions on mercy and justice. I think it was very helpful to hear that, because for me, as I grew up in the church, there was no real distinction between mercy and justice. My understanding was if you were merciful, you were being just. I don't believe that any longer. I believe if I'm merciful, it's undeserved. I may give, in fact, you know, $10 to the poor plate. That really came clear when we were in Atlanta. We worked for the Christian Council of Churches in Atlanta proper, and where 75% of the inner city is black, and the control and power basis is in the suburbs. And the richest county in the nation, one of them is DeKalb County, where Rock of Ages Lutheran Church sat. And they had the money. But we would go to these meetings, and it would come up every time. The plea was, Thanksgiving's coming, how are we going to feed? Let's help the poor out. And it was get the baskets and have this telethon. And we'd get 2,500 baskets, and we would serve it. It was And that was good, and it was charitable, and it was merciful, but it wasn't justice.
And justice is something that is deserved. See, that was, it was so hard for me to understand that, that you do have the right, and not just the right, but that you are to eat, and to have employment. And irregardless of how I feel about that personally. And so Chuck, I think, helps us with that. It's hard, though, how do we get to that stage? The next, we've been sitting in a group, the Oxfords are up here now. We met them a couple of years ago as they formed a peace support group in the Tacoma Lakewood area where people from churches and lay people gathered together, and we said, how are we going to support each other? Because it's kind of a lonely business in our normal congregation. And out of that came a group that meets every third week at Eve's Buffet off of Pacific Avenue, 7 a.m. in the morning, and we talk about peace issues. And for 2 years now. And now it is hitting us. How do we make that next step? How do we move now from that which has been given in very, you know, reflection, talk, to actually doing justice or heeding the call of Micah to do justice, to love kindness, to walk humbly with your God? I
have a sense of a tension in myself when I get down to. I want to jump right there. You know, in Washington State, we did a program called the Ecumenical Dialogue for Peace with Justice, and it was about 500 study groups across the state that went through this process last spring, and. The group I was in, when we got to the end, we're going, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Are we going to do something? And it's interesting that Latin American theology, liberation theology, which wants to emphasize doing, as opposed to waiting for God at the end of time, also is telling us that being, the way we are, being is maybe more important even than the doing. There needs to be some doing, but we shouldn't jump to it and ignore worship and ignore the reflection and ignore that kind of developing a sensitivity and an openness and an identification with the poor, that all of those things are critical. Otherwise, our doing is trying to work out our guilt, or it's trying to do God's job because he's not doing it.
Something like this one, Supreme Court law, I think the Episcopal lawyer was moving to the inner city with the blacks who was working, and he said, we want you to move in here with us. Keep your home in suburbia. That's you. But you're coming to work with us. That's the real. So the peace you're still playing with me.
There is a sense in which there has to be some moving in. I guess that would be the critique. In fact, I think the explosion of all of this, of liberation theology, came largely with Roman Catholic priests, primarily Jesuits, and Roman Catholic sisters, Mary Knoll especially, moving in and living, not in the cities in the cathedrals, but out in the poor communities with people, living at the same level, listening to them. In that process, they conferred dignity on the people that were there, and the people conferred learning on them. And then they began to see how the gospel could be applied in that situation. So there is a certain amount of living with.
The Peace Corps, in some cases, did that too.
Right. I think that the learning came to the Peace Corps people. I'm not sure they had... There was, I'm not sure exactly went the other way.
I think the hard, what about, but do we go in the same level? This is the hard part I have with it. I've watched too many people in South Bronx. This is so, such a crazy image that this man who was a very professional, he had he's the owner of a specialized magazine for architects or something, very exclusive. It costs like $70 a year to subscribe to it. And he bought this place in the South Bronx near St. Peter's Lutheran Church and School, all black. And he and his wife. And we were interviewing for the job, so the reason we got to know him. We went up there and we went into his house. And it was one of these row tenement places, and it was with all of them. And we went in the door, and what had happened, it was transformed. He had brought all of what he was out there into there. He had locked doors, special things. He had gutted the whole building. He had, it was just like a heaven amidst hell. And the intent, the reason why he wanted to identify and all the rest was clear. The man was well-meaning, to say the least. Yet he could not give up that which he came from. I mean, that's my tension I deal with when I think about moving into a city.
I think we have a strange, we have those two extremes. One is to carry all of what we were, and the other is to try to give up everything. And we set those up. Some of the things I read talk about being, the simplicity movement and the stress on that a few years ago, one of the phrases, downwardly mobile. that we simplify, and I'm struggling with that. 3 years ago, bought my first house. And then you got to have your own refrigerator, your own dishwater, you got all of these things to put in it.
Maybe two.
Yeah, and there's a sense in seeking to be downwardly mobile. Again, in one of the tapes, I've been listening, there's a lot of good tapes. I think John Schramm was quoted, or no, Dan quoted him here, I think, saying that we had passed, in the 1950s, we passed the time of sustainability, I think was the phrase. The time when it might be conceivable that the whole world could live at the level that we live. We passed that. That can't happen now. It's not a matter of, south of the folks in Latin America would say, we don't trust developmentalism. You're not going to bring us up. You know, that one, it just doesn't work that way. And two, it can't happen. A few years ago, I was at the Center for Cultural Documentation in Cuernavaca, and Ivan Illich was studying education. And he used this illustration, and this sticks in my mind. He said, Brazil passed a law that all of their children were to be educated just like we do in the United States, to the age of 16. And then they discovered that it would take the combined budgets of every country south of Texas to do that. And that's what he was about, was trying to find a different way of educating people. We have a tremendously, financially wasteful way of educating our children. And I'm all for passing a levy, you know, that's not what I'm saying. But the way we live is not generalizable. And that means that somehow we need to move down from that, somewhat. Yeah, and I don't think that there isn't community in the church. It's there.
Yeah.
And we ache for it. I really, you know, I think people really ache for it. And that's why I'm trying, for myself, I'm a pastor, I'm trying to get some handles on this. I sense that ache in my own people. Half my congregation at least is single or widowed, or, you know, they're alone. And the people that are living together are just feeling alone. We need these things, and I think we have a sense of that. And how we move toward it is happening. You know, I think it does happen. I'm interested in how can we encourage that. It's happening all over the world, and maybe at least in the United States, but in the United States too. I mean, Jim Wallace is working on things, on these intentional communities. They have Sojourners Community in Washington, D.C. Mary's had experience with Community Christ Servants. There are those landmark kind of ones, but there are more and more of those kinds of groups. But also in congregations at a different level, I think that's happening. We're realizing how important that is.
No, I don't want to downplay what you just said about sending someone that you trust. But isn't that what Thomas
Jesus who told us all about this? Like they were poor in the world?
That they were poor and that it was our job to be just. And that was the command.
But I think we do live, one of the characteristics was we don't know who to trust.
What about Jesus?
We have a very low trust quantity. Well, that was a long time ago, and we know Jesus was just trying to save our souls anyway. I mean, we don't make that connection.
Yeah. So there, to me, it gets down to a matter of faith. Do you really believe this stuff?
I know how I was converted. I remember how I was converted in a very significant way with social justice concerns. I went to work with a guy, and I was told, you're going to replace this guy. And I, you know, young seminary in first year, gee, is he a bad person? Should I not learn something from him? Well, you'll figure it out. Well, it turned out the guy I was working with was a member of the Chicago area draft resistance. And the employer wanted to get rid of him because he didn't like his politics. And we sat next to each other and we began comparing our lives and learning from one another and coming to trust one another. The conversion for me came through being with somebody that I trusted and seeing through their eyes the world in a different way than I saw. And then I had to go out and do it for myself. That was the other thing. I was Missouri Synod. I always believed what was right. If one person had something that was right, it was right for everybody, right? He kept saying, no, it's not that way. You have to figure it out for yourself. And I had to go through that process. But the thing that opened it up for me was being with someone that I learned to trust and seeing it through their eyes in a different way and maybe seeing some models and some things I wanted to try. And it was very tentative at first. That was a big conversion process. And I know how that worked. And I think that's really important. I hear what you're saying, too.
Yeah, I do, too. I mean, I believe it, but it's when somebody that you respect goes down and says, hey, it changed my life. And if you know if it changed their life, they really, it meant something.
Yeah. And I think we need to end, but I think Global, you have a copy there, I see, of Global Perspectives, which is a helpful thing that comes out of Augsburg. And I know a lot of our bishops have gone down to Central America. And again, I'd like to say that, at least from this area, maybe you've had your bishop, but when Bishop Lundy came back, you would not call Bishop Lundy exactly the most political activist. He's a true man of piety and faith and prayer. But when he came back and he told us his story to you, and he's still, the tears still come as he relates it. He doesn't give us answers. What do we do? You're right. But he does reaffirm that by faith it is happening there. And to get beyond that which keeps us from seeing these people and hearing them. And I can only say, I'll close my hand, that a lot of the liberation theologians that have been to visit us at our university have said, every one of them has said the same thing, don't come down there and try to solve our problem. Would you please stay in your communities, in your churches, and help with the being able to receive what we can give you and then work from there.
One of the hardest jobs is for us, I sense, as Lutherans and as white middle class, to be able to share our own stories with each other.
And with help.
Our own histories, that, like you say, that conversion came, that you shared your story and heard somebody else's. And to learn to trust through that.
But our
community.
I really, see, that's where I am in my life. I am looking to enter in, I need that to be effective as a pastor. I need a closer sense of community. One thing I didn't put on here about community that Latin Americans would say is essential is that it's lay-led. The base communities are lay-led. Everybody is responsible for the community. If a priest is a member of it, he's a member of it. And they don't have leaders. They have coordinators, animators, they have all sorts of, but there's no leaders. Now, the priest does another function and has that leadership role within the larger church. But in the immediate community, it's that sense of everybody is a participant in it. And we've got so much to share together.